สัมภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนะมัสสามิ Seems like a long time ago that I've been sitting here andoffering some reflections, but must be about a month or so, for various reasons, retreat period in September and then a time of absence in Czech Republic. I think would be a good way to start to reflect tonight is actually what happened to me in Czech Republic. Some of you might have heard that I came back much lighter.From Czech Republic than when I went. I was relieved of all my luggage before my return journey, so my whole suitcase with all the alms bowl and sangati and winter clothes and shoes and a few books and personal belongings, of course, were all gone. Somebody stole my suitcase from a car and the phone of a friend, also a rucksack.So I just came back with the bare necessities, well, less than the necessities, actually, with what I came back with. I couldn't survive much longer. Fortunately, I could come back into this safe haven of the monastery and then reflect on what had happened. Of course, such an event is always a bit of a stir. It doesn't go unnoticed.I didn't just shrug it off and say, oh, well, that's the way it goes, here you go, you know. There are people like that in the world who don't follow any ethical principles. They go around looking what they can get from other people. And yes, that's certainly true, but I also had to, of course, acknowledge how this affected me. You know, it was a little bit of a shocker when it comes out of the blue, so to speak. You're just having a meal somewhere, thinking of nothing, evil or bad or so, and suddenly something like that happens. But then, of course, as a meditator, as a practitioner, one also always reflects on it. And I didn't so much go into seeking for causes and conditions, what led to this, if this had to do with, you know, if it's a retribution for some unwholesome karma I had created when I was younger, when I also did some irregular things like that little acts of, you know, taking possession of things which didn't really belong to me, and if this is now a late retribution for that, could be, I don't know. This is speculative. But what I had to acknowledge is how it affected me, and of course there's a person, I'm personally affected by it, and the sense of loss, and suddenly this is gone, and that is gone, and so on, and of course... Also to reflect on how much emotional investment I had into certain things. And of course, as they were not of a lot of monetary value, still there were some, emotional attachments. Or as we say in German, sentimental value. Things of sentimental value, of gifts people had given to me. And as I live a lifestyle where everything I own is given to me, and I have actually a very good memory of the people who have given things to me. I always remember who gave me this alms bowl and the bowl stand, who gave me the sangati 20 years ago, and so forth. And my sister bought me these shoes, and I remember these things. And it's also very pleasant to always remember the goodness of people, you know, the generosity. So the other side of the spectrum, there are good people in this world who act on the basis of generosity and kindness. And of course, if those people wouldn't exist, well, that would be a hell realm, wouldn't it? The world would be a hell realm if we would only be surrounded by thieves and people committed to, you know, those kind of acts or cruelty and violence and so forth. Yes, there is this in the world. There is a lot of violence in the world, cruelty, and also... people steal and do really bad things, but also there's a lot of goodness and I trust, of course, more in that, part of humanity which can manifest that goodness in many, many different modes of expression. I remember when my teacher, Ajahn Sumedho, was asked by his teacher, by Lompo Cha, to go and start a little vihara in London, in England. He was really doubtful. He thought, well, how could this, is this possible, you know, to live? It was in, say, mid-70s when Buddhism wasn't quite so well known yet in Europe, maybe more just on a scholastic level. It's a lot of, kind of, especially in the Theravada tradition, a lot of scholars, but not a lot of practitioners or monasteries even. And so Ajahn Sumedho had doubts if this would actually take off in European culture. And he said this to Lompo Cha. I said, well, you know, you think this really works, you know? Going like an alms mendicant into London. He lived in London the first couple of years, living on donations and generosity of others. And I don't know. The people don't know the customs. They don't know, you know, how Buddhist monks operate, that they live on alms and donations. And Ajahn Chah, he wasn't so much concerned about that conventional side. He was asking Ajahn Sumedho a counter question. He said, well, do you really think that there's no goodness in England, in Britain? There's no good people in Britain? Do you think that? No. And then, of course, he had to admit, no, there are good people in Britain, of course. And he'd already met some of them just right from the start. There were people who showed, you know, their willingness to support and show an interest in the Dhamma and so forth. So, slowly and gradually, the whole thing then developed and developed very well. And then, now, what, 30 years later or so, 35 years later, you have, you know, very solidly established monasteries and a couple of hermitages and so forth, and little branches elsewhere. And that's, of course, all based on the manifestation of goodness, of kindness, of generosity, and people taking that as a practice. Traditionally, of course, in Asian cultures, the practice of generosity has a particular taste to it. One could say people are very familiar with the term of making merit, you know, earning blessings, so forth, in order, and very often they speak like that, in order to then gain a better rebirth the next time round. This time round, they don't expect too much, but they providing good conditions, so to speak, so that they have something more, what they wish for in the next life. And yes, it's not completely wrong, but usually the approach of a Western person, a European person, or North American is a bit different, because most Western people are very interested in meditation and in mind cultivation. They're interested in the practices which actually can transform our minds, can transform our hearts. At least that's what we expect. But of course, also acts of generosity, of kindness, they also transform our hearts, don't they? Transform our hearts from an egoic or egotistical concern about me and myself, what I can get out of life, what I can accumulate, and how I can get ahead of everyone and make $1 million and so forth. You know, there's a lot of people who operate like that. So if you go in a different way and manifest generous heart, make this, you know, on a regular basis, not just a one-off thing, now and then, on somebody's birthday or so, but regularly, then that also, of course, transforms our heart. And because it goes against the grain of egoic habits, of the feelings and the thoughts and the concerns about me and mine, what I want, what I need, what I want to get out of life. And this is not, of course, to put down or be underestimated. And of course, ideally, all these things go together. You know, the actions in the world, what we do in the social context, in society, in the family, and so forth, and what we do when we sit with ourselves and just focus on our own inner processes, to acknowledge what's happening, to acknowledge where our hearts contract, where we get, where we sense and feel manifestation of egoic concerns, yes. And that is, of course, very important, but it's not one or the other, but it's one and the other. Both things are very important. And also in this context, to consider and contemplate what one could call the difference between what we would call conventional reality and ultimate reality. Conventional reality is the area of social conventions which we have, forms of etiquette in the way we deal in the dealings with each other in social context and so forth. Also the ethical aspects of our lives, so forth, that one could call conventional reality. And then ultimate reality is more concerned, one could say, with what we truly are, what we really are, who or what we really are. And not to let that sound too abstract. And when we're speaking of, if you're speaking of conventional reality, for example, in the case of my little adventure in Czech Republic, when the things were stolen from the car of my friend, then yes, certainly someone personally very concerned and involved, and my things are stolen from me. And I am the owner of these things. These things belong to me, and nobody else should take these away. This is not right. This is talking in terms of conventional reality. But then we could make a shift to, a reality where this doesn't really apply. I mean, these things are not really mine, are they? I'm not really the owner of these things which were in that suitcase. I'm not really owner of things I have now on my body. I'm not even the owner of this very body itself. This is when we come to the realm of, that's what I call ultimate reality. That's the when we shift our perspective, shift our contemplations to call the reality which is really different from what one could call conventional reality. Conventional reality is all about certain structures we hold in life, and this is yours, this is mine, this is him, this is her, and so forth. This belongs to him, this belongs to her. And that's fine, has its place, of course. It's not, again, one against the other. One is better than the other. It's just, for us, it's very important to know which reality we are dealing with when we are thinking and contemplating about events, occurrences in our life. And of course, this contemplation can help. When I'm looking at this event which took place, these things taken away, when I have actually the space in my mind to consider, hey, they are not really mine. Actually, I never really owned them. It was just on a level of convention that I owned them. They were given to me, and that was a very nice convention, Buddhist convention, that Buddhist monks receive gifts, beautiful, because it has to do with our hearts. The giver manifests something beautiful, and hopefully the receiver also manifests something beautiful. And of course, I can be right there and then. I can be aware of the fact that it's not really mine. And we are actually encouraged that in the teachings to consider it like that. There have been, even when I was training as a young monk, there was even the encouragement and the training suggestion, you shouldn't even consider the food which is offered in your bowl as yours. Because as long as you're not fully awakened, you're having a debt with the Buddha. Because, you're eating, you're accumulating debts, you're eating every day, the alms food of the faithful, as they say. They're giving you the support and so forth, they're giving you requisites, they're giving you medicine and clothes and offer you shelter and so forth. But it's only when you have realized awakening that then you are no more in debt than you've done or needed to be done. And I remember when I heard this for the first time, I didn't really like that very much, because I didn't enter monastic life with the kind of idea to develop a debt or even a huge debt, you know. And now I've been living in the Sangha for 30 years or so. Gosh, my goodness, I can't really claim full awakening, so, you know, how can I ever pay this back? But the good news is, you know, we have to, again, there consider conventional reality. Conventional reality is also time. Time is a conventional reality. I think, oh man, 30 years, I'm not fully awakened, so when will, you know, when will this be? Will this be this life, or need many more lives, how many more lives? And, you know, the conventional mind thinks like that about conventional reality. But when we're speaking, again, shifting what we call ultimate reality, contemplations of our experience as it is in the present moment, not taken in by such concerns or, you know, personal investments, taking this all very personal, thinking about, you know, personal entity moving forward in time in order to get enlightened in 10 years, in 20 years or whenever, or next week, doesn't really matter. As soon as we actually do that, the whole terrain becomes a bit tricky. Because in the teachings are never actually saying that, never suggestion to make never the suggestion to us that it's about, you know, moving forward, and then, you know, probably within a certain time, then you, and sometimes they are even given time spans, at least in the most vaguest sense. Huh? They say when you enter the first level of awakening, when you enter the stream, become a stream enterer, that then you have at the most 7 more lifetimes, at the very most, but probably less, before you realize full awakening. So, yes, that's interesting to hear. Huh? Maybe some people believe it straight away, some people disbelieve it. It's not so, I would say, it's not so incredibly vital if we believe it or disbelieve it, but more see this, you know, again, we're talking about conventional realities. They are kind of propositions made, ideas tossed out about what can happen or could happen if we practice accordingly. But then when we attend to the immediacy of our experience in the present moment, the whole thing looks very differently. Huh? In fact, all concerns about when will I get enlightened, when will I realize the truth, is this real? Asking oneself, is this real what I'm experiencing now? Some, you know, to acknowledge maybe that we have a tendency to doubt and to confuse things because we tend to always be upstairs in the head and anticipate things, think about developing the path and constantly monitoring our own experience as we're sitting and meditating. Of course, then that is not really the way forward. That's actually a good sign that we are stuck. We're just ruminating our old habits of thinking, self-concern, you know, all the thoughts and feelings and so forth, are always concerned about a sense of self, a me and mine. And of course that is very much in question when we're looking at, say, a deeper level of practice. That sense of me and mine is very much in question. And we are encouraged to investigate that, what that is. Is there a way to experience reality, by that I mean moment-to-moment reality, without the concern about me and mine, without that constant, you know, ruminating inside, is this right, and is this good, is this bad, and am I closer to awakening now, am I far away, have I made any progress at all, and so forth. These kind of concerns we can very easily develop, hopefully not develop as part of the path, but we can develop it in one meditation session. Huh? We can see that we can get carried away about, you know, such concerns, or even much more less significant thoughts and feelings, trivial stuff even. A lot of meditators report that most of what they experience, and say on a meditation retreat, what goes on through their mind, is of the most trivial value, you know, has no value at all, in other words. And so it should be easy to let that go. But then what people do is, of course, they evaluate their experience. They call themselves maybe bad names because they have such thoughts or recurring thoughts of triviality, of insignificance and so forth. And they're waiting for the big experience, for the big bright light going up where they have a sense of, something's happening now. I'm having a major breakthrough. So this, these considerations of these different ways of reality can be for us very careful if we do it carefully. And we also, of course, have the hint in the teachings. It's hint towards that what is to be realized, the unconditioned or nibbana, the goal of the practice. Is not based on causal factors. There are no direct causal factors to realize the truth or realize nibbana. Otherwise, one could just go follow a scheme of A, B, C, D, and then bingo, you're there, and awakening is fully realized. On the other hand, again, there is a very clear indication of a path, isn't there? You have an eightfold path. It's pointing to, you know, something to develop, to go somewhere, isn't it? That's what the path usually indicates. You walk along a path to get somewhere, don't you? If I want to go from here to Thun or to Bern, then I, you know, go out on the road and follow the signposts. And then, hopefully, eventually, I'll get there. But, of course, the important thing is that I don't create Thun, I don't create Bern. Bern is already there. Thun is already there. I don't even have to think about Bern and Thun. You know, when I'm on the road, I know, okay, this is the signpost, I just follow it and walk along. And then, whoopee, soon comes Thun, and later on comes Bern. And so we could see also, we could take that analogy on the spiritual path. If we're constantly thinking about Nibbana, awakening, and, you know, or the different stages of awakening, we might actually miss where the signposts are pointing to. And that's how I also see the Eightfold Path. And as you know, we have it in front of the monastery. The Eightfold Path is not a linear progression of steps, but it's a wheel with eight spokes. And these eight spokes, they all say pointing. You could use it like that. Pointing to a center. And what is the center? It's our own heart, isn't it? It's about the development of the heart. The eight path factors are there to develop our human heart. And so that's, in a way, to use a more modern term, you could call that more a holistic way of seeing it. We're getting more the whole picture. The eight path factors, we have, say, three sections. We have an ethical part, very important, of how we act and speak in the world, interact with other human beings. Then we have the livelihood path, we're not earning a livelihood here, but how you earn your livelihood. Is your livelihood based on integrity? Is it serving to foster and develop the good, the wholesome, the true, the beautiful in the world? Or is your livelihood based on, you know, just getting maximum benefit on a monetary side, just making loads and loads of money so that you can live a more comfortable life? Or even worse, is it supporting something which is ethical, not integral? Sometimes actually people don't realize that before they asking themselves this question, what context they are working, for example. I remember once someone speaking to me. He was working for a firm who does. They make these turbines for airplanes, and He didn't realize that his company were also doing machines for the weapon industry. And so that brought him into a big conflict, because he could see, even though he didn't know it wasn't his intention to do it, but in the context he was working, he was actually supporting something which was making a contribution to the unwholesomeness, to the negative aspects of and expressions of human endeavor, of the work sphere, of the livelihood sphere. And then we have the wisdom part of the Eightfold Path. Also, we're looking at our attitude, we're looking at our view, what views we hold, that we have a basic understanding of karma, how cause and effect work specifically in our life from moment to moment. And as I said, we can't cause nibbana in this analogy with a mountain. That's definitely not possible, but we can certainly provide conditions, wholesome conditions, based on our view, how we view ourselves and the world around us, and our understanding of how we operate in the world. We understand wholesome karma and unwholesome karma. We have a basic understanding of the teachings on the Four Noble Truths. That's usually also considered the right view, the right understanding. That we are, really concerned about the vital things of the Buddhist path. And the Buddhist path is about, as the Buddha once put it, it's about suffering and the ending of suffering, isn't it? If it really, you can't be putting it more into a nutshell than that. The Four Noble Truths is still quite a compact teaching. If you look at them on the text level, the text message of it is quite compact. But we need, if we apply it to our own experience, then the thing becomes a little bit more alive and a bit more rich, and becomes a constant accompanying base for reflection. That is there unsatisfactoriness in our lives? Just to ask that simple question. At least a little bit of irritation now and then, every second Thursday or so, maybe that, at the very least. If you can say yes to that, then there's obviously some work to do, isn't there? If you have, of course, the aspiration in your heart to go beyond it, to go beyond any form of oppression, of stress, of doubt, of worry, of fear, of anxiety, of greed, hatred, and delusion, basically. And then we're looking into the causal conditions. If we clear that we want to at least not consciously increase the causes for more suffering and more stress, then what can we do to move in the opposite direction, to decrease the causes for more suffering? And of course, an important form is in that area I've just mentioned, is in the way we live our lives. But then you could say more fundamental importance lies in the way how we meet ourselves, how we meet our own experience directly, when we're looking into the causes of suffering within our heart. And maybe we discover, oh, it's this one, it's this heart, or it's this mind, which is responsible, which creates causes for suffering, through our attachments, through our unrealistic investment into a sense of me and mine, and holding on to things we don't really have any control over or don't really belong to us. And of course, initially I spoke about the external things which surround us, the material things we have, we live with, we surround us with, and they are really, it doesn't take much introspection to recognize that they are really not ours. But then when it comes to our bodies and our minds and so forth, then it gets a little bit, we're coming to the heart of the issue. To investigate that. What kind of investment do we have with these ego-producing mechanisms? And we can always be quite sure that ego is manifesting and at work when we experience some form of resistance, some form of contraction, something goes tight and rigid in ourselves. Or when we have obsessive longings and desire for something, we really have this feeling, I must have that. Without that, I cannot live. Maybe we don't even say this to ourselves subconsciously. It might actually be a good thing, because then we realize how absurd it is to think or let alone speak like that. But sometimes we feel like this, and we have these obsessive drives in us. We want something, you know, we feel, I have to have this now. Can't be without this. And I want this now, without delay. And that is, of course, this is an attitude that's even supported in consumer society, you know, in the bigger picture. I remember someone who mentioned once a big billboard in America, and he saw it on the freeway driving across California, where a big billboard announced, take the waiting out of wanting. Big sign. Take the waiting out of wanting. I think it was an advertisement for a debit card or so, you know. Buy now, pay later. Don't have to wait. You want something? Get it right now. You know, want something? Now. Why wait? And of course, that is a kind of interesting pointer, isn't it? And it points to a kind of, you could say, maybe undercurrent or background of how consumer society, capitalistic society functions at large. And I'm also of the opinion that this, of course, also influences us. We've been influenced by that. Not that this wasn't there before consumer society arose in this last century, that it wasn't there before. It was there 2,600 years ago. The Buddha spoke about this. It was there before the Buddha even appeared in the world. People were having wantings, obsessive desires, and thought they couldn't live without this, that, or the other. And then, if it's not material objects and things and goods and so forth, then at the very least, we want to be identified with what we think or feel is me, is mine, on a very personal level, concerning the personal attributes we see we have in ourselves. You know, we think we're a good person or a bad person, of course, that the special attitude many people in the modern Western world have is that they're very critical towards themselves. They have more critical views, see themselves more with a bad light. And some people even think that that's very honest. If you're like that, you're very honest. You admit all your faults and mistakes and your personality weaknesses. But I think also sometimes there's a lot of people just overdo it and dramatize it. That's more than being, very often more than being honest. It's actually being under the influence of a tyrannical aspect in ourselves, calling every, you know, identifying with those things which might not be perfect, might not be how we wish ourselves to be or to see ourselves. But there's no need to dramatize this into huge melodrama and call ourselves big names. Yes, the honesty, as I mentioned, if we want to free ourselves from dukkha, from unsatisfactoriness, we need to acknowledge where we get stuck, huh? Where this obsessive longing and the resistances and the fighting and so forth, inner fighting and arguing and so forth, where it manifests. And then learn through the introspection, especially, of course, the practices of sati, of mindfulness, and combination with calm, with clarity and so forth, are very important. And, you know, that we apply ourselves, but we actually manifest some energy, and that's actually now, and talking like this, I'm completing the last factors of the Eightfold Path, where it comes to the direct spiritual practice, the inner work, so to speak, which we do, yes, to a great extent on the cushion, but of course also with the idea in the back of our minds that it's not just resting on the cushions. We're not about just staying calm or being calm or becoming more mindful or becoming more focused, becoming more, achieving more clarity. And it's not about becoming, actually. It's about being. Being as clear, as mindful as it's possible for us at every given moment. without putting undue pressure on us with an achieving mind, with a goal-getting mind. And this is a subtle thing. You really have to watch out for that. If the goal-getting mind is involved, if you're thinking only even for the split second that you want more of this, that, or the other, you're off the mark. You're off the immediacy of reality as it manifests in the moment. You are creating a new reality based on your expectations, based on your projection into the future. And that's no catastrophe. Again, that's also something we can acknowledge, we can see. I have the constant tendency to project myself into the future, even if the future is only the next moment. And if we see that, if we detect that, then okay, there we are. If I detect that and stop that mechanism, there I am. I'm connected with the immediacy of my experience. I'm being aware rather than becoming it in the future. I'm being mindful, or as Professor Meda always liked to put it, being awareness rather than becoming awareness or becoming mindfulness in the future. And yes, admittedly, it's a subtle point. Maybe you could call it even a tricky point. But that's again something where the teachings are pointing to, that we realize these mechanisms in the here and now, in through our direct experience. We can read about it and listen to talks and witness other people's commentaries about this until the cows go home, and we won't really benefit from it. Huh? I remember reading an account of two of the very renowned forest masters, the old days, Nungpo Man and one other man who was accompanying him. They were visiting Burma on their tudongs. They had a long visit to Burma where they visited the country of Burma, who is very renowned for their very refined scholasticism. You know, as you know, they have a very refined Abhidhamma system, which is a systemization of the Buddhist teachings in a psychological and even philosophical way, where everything is really written down in great detail. All the different subtle mind moments are listed out in the scriptures of the Abhidhamma, the scriptures which they have developed to such a refined level. And it's all wonderful, and it's good, and it's helpful if you know what you're doing. If you're knowing that you're using the map, huh? They're giving us the map, you could say, of the mind. We can point at this or that and say, this is about this aspect of the mind, this is about that. But if you're just staying on the map, and this is what Lumpur Man was saying to his friend, you know, he has the impression a lot of people in Burma at that time, that's a long time ago, and I'm not sure if this is still the case like that, probably some people still do, but also, of course, there's a very vital in the life practice tradition in Burma. So don't get me wrong, I'm not dismissing Burmese tradition here. This comment Lumpur Man made, that you actually have to walk the terrain, isn't it? You have to walk the very terrain these scriptures and books are talking about. Otherwise, you're just somebody who goes, you know, traveling to a different country, exploring a new country, and you're taking all the maps with you. You have your now GPS on your smartphone, and you're standing there at the street corner and moving your GPS up and down. You're not actually going there. You're not walking the terrain. You're not breathing the air. You're not feeling the temperature. You're not meeting the people. You're not seeing the trees, how the wind blows through them. You're not wading through the rivers. You're not crossing the roads and so forth. Nobody can take that away from us. We have to walk the path. We have to immerse ourselves in our inner exploration and then discover the truth as we go along from moment to moment. And then if we do that, then we will certainly realize, and eventually we realize, the mountain, that mountain has been there all along. Huh? We haven't created the mountain, if we're going back to that analogy. The mountain to which the path is leading, if you want to call it the mountain of awakening or Nibbana, We have simply applied ourselves, to the basic principles, you know, the Eightfold Path, and then eventually, if we do this persistently, regularly, continuously, without giving in, without getting slack, without getting lost in doubts and worries and too many concerns about me and my progress, then eventually, you could maybe say the mountain or Nibbana will reveal itself. Because it's the, as the Buddha said, it's the uncreated, the unconditioned, that which has no origin, which has no birth, is never born and cannot die. And so, of course, that is something which is outside of what we call conventional reality. That is ultimate reality, isn't it? And ultimate reality is not something we create, but is something certainly within the scope of our abilities as human beings. We all have that potential to realize that, to awaken to that, you could say. Just do the first step and simply keep going.